This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, December 16th, 2009. From New York City, I'm Doran Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, in Copenhagen, negotiations unravel as heads of state arrive to the conference. We'll get a report from the Copenhagen streets and from inside the Bella Center.
2 years of work look like they're still up in the air, unresolved, and with less than 2 days to go.
We knew there'd be arrests. There've been arrests throughout the week. That's what we expected because the police are protecting the big carbon-heavy industries as they've been doing all along.
And the U.S. Senate attempts to take up debate on a plan for single-payer healthcare, but is stalled by Republicans who demand the more than 700-page proposal is read aloud. Those stories and more right after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Iran announced today it has tested a long-range missile powerful enough to reach Israel and some parts of Europe. In response, the U.S. State Department has rebuked the move, saying it undermines Iran's assertions that it has peaceful intentions. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown said the launch furthers the case for sanctions. Switzerland says it will take one of the prisoners the U.S. government is trying to move from Guantanamo. Several other European nations have also volunteered to take prisoners from the U.S. detention center. President Obama's plan to close the facility by January has been delayed as the government struggles to place the prisoners elsewhere. Yesterday, the Obama administration announced it would move up to 100 detainees at Guantanamo to a prison facility in Illinois. A chaotic scene in the Punjab province of central Pakistan today as smoke and the sounds of sirens filled the air. A car bomb exploded outside a market and killed more than 20 people. The target was apparently a senior Pakistani politician whose home was nearby. The Bolivian government has expressed anger at the U.S. over the Andean Trade Promotion and Drug Eradication Act. Earlier this week, the U.S. House of Representatives approved a one-year extension that excludes Bolivia. Lenny Oliveira reports from Cochabamba.
Bolivia's government criticized the U.S. House of Representatives for once again excluding it from the Andean Trade Promotion and Drug Eradication Act. The act was born in the early 90s to foster economic development in the region and combat narcotics production. Originally, Peru, Ecuador, Colombia, and Bolivia were allowed to export thousands of products to the United States duty-free, as long as they cooperate with the U.S. war on drugs. Bolivia was first excluded from this agreement in 2008, when the Bush administration argued the country was not respecting its commitments satisfactorily. Bolivian Vice President Álvaro García Linera calls the continued exclusion retaliation because Bolivia no longer subordinates itself to the U.S. He announced that he will continue to seek other markets for Bolivian products. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lenny Oliveira from Cochabamba, Bolivia.
Representatives from British Airways and the Unite Union are meeting today after cabin crews from the airline announced they would go on strike for 2 weeks beginning next week. Crews are fighting changes to their pay and work conditions being implemented by the airline. They say the changes are a breach of their contract. The airline claims the pending strike is illegal because of faulty union balloting and is challenging the decision in British court. A strike during the busy holiday season would impact a million travelers, according to an airline representative. Baggage handlers and other UK airport staff, specifically at Heathrow and Aberdeen airports, plan multi-day strike actions over the holidays as well. In addition, the drivers of the Eurostar train service plan to strike for 4 days in protest of what they consider substandard meal per diems. Eurostar is perhaps best known for connecting the UK and France through the Channel. The FBI has issued hate crimes indictments for two Pennsylvania teens. A local court convicted Derek Donchak and Brandon Pekarski of assault in the beating death of Luis Ramirez in July of 2008 and sentenced them both to less than 2 years in jail. Witnesses say they heard racial slurs being used during the attack, and many accused the police department of mishandling the case. The federal indictments also charged Yonchik and three members of the Shenandoah Police Department, including the chief, with obstruction of justice. Police allegedly helped the teens cover up their crime, lied to federal investigators, and destroyed evidence. Gladys Limon, the lawyer for Ramirez's fiance, spoke to CNN.
It's been very difficult for her, so this has provided some sense of relief and will provide her with a sense of peace this Christmas.
If convicted for federal hate crimes, Yonchik and Pekarsky could serve life in prison. The officers face sentences of 20 years for each count of obstruction. The police officers have pleaded not guilty and are scheduled to attend a bail hearing today. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. In the streets of Copenhagen today, clashes between police and protesters caused chaos as thousands marched on the Bella Center and activists inside staged a walkout. An estimated 260 people were arrested, according to the UK's Guardian newspaper. Brian Edwards Tickert has more from Copenhagen.
Organizers had planned to have multiple groups converge on the convention center where the talks are taking place, then breach the perimeter to hold a people's assembly inside. Police bottled some of those groups up at a train station, preventing them from reaching the center, but also delaying the trains the delegates were taking to the talks by up to an hour.
This train has been delayed. You have to leave the train and wait for a train from
Manchester. Don't read our banners and they call us hooliganers.
From the other side of the convention center, a legally permitted march approached, flanked by street theater groups, clowns, and a heavy police escort. During the legal march, plainclothes police officers plunged into the crowd to drag out and arrest at least one of the principal organizers. Here's Dan Glass of Climate Justice Action.
We knew there'd be arrests. There have been arrests throughout the week. That's what we expected because the police are protecting the big carbon-heavy industries as they've been doing all along and not listening to what the climate scientists have got to say. It's really desperate times, and that's why we're here to take action and say that actually we don't need to go home deflated from Copenhagen because we can stand in solidarity and support each other. I mean, people from the global north and global south have been speaking to each other to make connections and actually work together for real just solutions, such as leaving fossil fuels in the ground. I'm going to go over here.
All right, thank you.
People in the front!
People in the front!
We need to push!
We need to push!
To the police house!
The mood turned confrontational once the crowd arrived at the Bella Center. Protesters tried to push through lines of riot police. And police pushed back, hit protesters with batons, and sent jets of pepper spray into the crowd. It appears none of the protesters managed to penetrate into the Bella Center. They report that some 300 delegates and observers did walk out and managed to meet them after initially being turned around by police. Brian Edwards Tickert, FSRN, Copenhagen.
And back inside the Climate Change Conference Center, relations among negotiators appeared to reach a new level of discord. Several countries raised more concerns over the behind-closed-doors negotiating process. They also complained of a lack of access to the conference venue for delegates and environmental advocates. FSRN's Jenny Johnson has more.
As protesters-led walkouts and interrupted some meetings this morning inside the Bella Center, tense negotiations continued. The day began with a major schedule change that riled delegates who had labored throughout the night and into the morning on a key part of the text of the new treaty. It is expected to contain greenhouse gas reduction commitments through 2050 and other major elements. The schedule removed the review of the results of the previous night's work and pushed it to later in the day, but that meeting was repeatedly delayed throughout the day. Then came the surprise resignation of Connie Hedegaard as the president of the Conference of Parties, who had been leading the negotiations here in Copenhagen. Replacing Hedegaard is the Danish Prime Minister Lars Rasmussen. He remains a controversial figure after many G77 countries accused the Danish presidency of secrecy and backdoor dealing. Soon after taking the reins, Rasmussen announced that Denmark would present two new compromise texts for ministers to consider for the new treaty. This news prompted immediate protests from Brazil, South Africa, Sudan, and China, who said the move reflected the lack of transparency that has characterized the conference. Jeremy Hobbs of Oxfam International described the status of the negotiation as in crisis.
After nearly 2 weeks of volatile and pretty acrimonious negotiation, 2 years of work look like they're still up in the air, unresolved, and with less than 2 days to go. It's pretty obvious that this is beyond negotiators and beyond ministers to resolve, and so we are strongly hoping that this will now be taken to the political level by heads of state, where it needs to be resolved politically.
Many advocates say several areas of disagreement remain, and only the highest political levels can make deals on financing, reduction commitments, and other areas where more needs to be done. But as heads of state gave marathon speeches in a plenary session, negotiators struggled to come to terms with the various treaty texts. One delegate from the African bloc expressed hope that the day will end with some kind of deal being reached.
So it is not clear, but we are waiting to have at least political agreement at the end of the day.
Things are still progressing then, and it's not like the talks have broken down at this point.
Yeah, we can say that progressing, but not as expected.
Speaking at a press conference this afternoon, European Union President José Manuel Barroso indicated that the heads of state may indeed be able to break through some of the barriers.
Prime Minister Reinfeldt and myself, representing the European Union, had a very constructive and very useful meeting just now with Prime Minister Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia and the President of the African Union Commission, Jean Ping. I think there is a real determination amongst leaders to succeed, certainly with my colleagues here before you today. We have no more time to lose. We need to get a real negotiating process underway as soon as possible. We need now to focus our attention on what can be the elements of a deal.
This high-level intervention reflects the demands of activists like Kumi Naidu, the director of Greenpeace International.
We would like to see the same kind of political will by world leaders, particularly the rich countries, that they showed 18 months ago when they mobilized trillions of dollars to bail out the banks, the bankers, and the bonuses. They now need to actually show that same political will to bail out the future of our children and grandchildren.
Meanwhile, conference security has kept hundreds of ministers and accredited NGOs from entering the conference. But after today's protests inside the Bella Center, the UN's Ivo de Boer offered no apologies for the decreased access.
I do not believe, on the basis of my experience, that there is anything anywhere where you have such access and such transparency. But at the same time, I must say that the incidents that have taken place today inside the conference center test my courage to continue in this way.
The conference attendees who have had their credentials revoked will not be allowed into the main venue for the rest of the conference. Danish officials set up an alternative conference center in another part of town. But some groups like Friends of the Earth are pressuring de Boer to open up the conference again, calling the crackdown a worrying trend. Jenny Johnson, FSRN.
Today in Burma, detained pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi met with leaders of her political party, the National League for Democracy. It's the first time in a year that she has been able to meet with the party's leaders. And it seems that at least one of the topics of the talks was a reorganization of the party that could come ahead of a national election in 2010. To discuss today's meeting and what it means for Burma, we're joined by Ang Zhao. He's an editor at the Burmese news magazine Irrawaddy, based in Thailand. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Yeah, thank you. Welcome.
So what came out of these discussions today?
The meeting was still very sketchy, what they had discussed, but as far as we gather, and then they had talked about the reorganizing of the party, particularly the reform possibility hinting that the leadership reshuffle at the NLD party, which a lot of observers inside and outside of Burma were saying that even before the meeting today taking place, saying that, suggesting that Aung San Suu Kyi may request and our Asian NLD leaders to retire so that the new blood and the new members or youth members will take place the leadership role.
So let's get a little history of the party. The National League for Democracy was founded in 1988. That's during the political upheaval in the country, right, that led to Aung San Suu Kyi's election in 1990. But now it's 20 years later. So how has the party changed?
I think the party, I don't see the party as a functional opposition party, because of the NLD party was decapitated, beheaded, so to speak, because of they have faced a brutal crackdown from the military government. But at the same time, the party is seen as a house for the different kinds of people, opposition members, youth, veteran politicians, intellectuals, former army officers who wanted to oppose the military government, all came to join another party. So it was a kind of a problem there, because of it's not founded by any like-minded politicians or activists.
Well, this week, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton spoke about Burma. She mentioned plans for a, quote, measured engagement with the country. She was also speaking in that speech about relations with Iran. The U.S. has maintained sanctions against Burma for years, but the Obama administration has moved more towards diplomacy. And as you say, Aung San Suu Kyi herself has recently requested meetings with the military leaders. Is the strategy changing here?
I think there's a shift from the U.S. and other Europeans and Asian governments toward the military government, but the regime hasn't shown any political will or any interest to engage a meaningful dialogue with the opposition parties. So I think a lot of people were very disappointed because there hasn't been any progress at all. Either you engage with the military leaders, either you adopted the new policies, or either you want to hold dialogue with them. So I'm very skeptical of seeing change in Burma.
And finally, talking about change, looking ahead to 2010 and scheduled elections, Aung San Suu Kyi is under house arrest. She's been either detained or under house arrest for 14 of the past 20 years. And in August, there was a decision to give her an additional 18 months under house arrest. So what role can she play and her political party play in the elections next year?
Well, either she's on house arrest or outside of house arrest, she's still very influential, I would say. I mean, she's very, she will continue to play a vital role. It wouldn't matter whether she's on house arrest or she enjoys the freedom. So even at a very brief window of opportunity prior to the election, whatever she say concerning the election will have a very big impact on the election. So I think military leaders know that. So I am very doubtful that she'll be released before the election. Even if she's released, there must be some kind of conditions, there must be some kind of meaningful compromise, there must be some kind of concessions reached between the two sides.
We've been speaking with Ang Zhao, an editor with Irrawaddy, a Burmese news magazine based in Thailand. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
On Capitol Hill today, Republicans successfully defeated a proposal to create a single-payer health care plan. Independent Senator Bernie Sanders withdrew an amendment that aimed to cover every American legally residing in the country with health insurance. Republicans had launched a procedural move to read aloud the entire 700-plus page amendment, thus effectively blocking the debate on health care and threatening Democratic plans to pass the bill before Christmas. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
Sanders was just about to talk about his single-payer amendment when Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma asked the Senate clerk to read the amendment out loud. All 767 pages of it.
Section 4401, Centers of Excellence. Section 4402, Healthcare Professionals Training for Diversity.
For a while, Senator Sanders was unruffled and instead welcomed the attention.
Senator Coburn is so impressed by the Medicare for All single payer program that he apparently feels that all of the people of our country have got to hear every single word for the next many, many hours about how a single program will be the only way to bring universal, comprehensive, cost-effective health care to all Americans. So I really do appreciate his desire to make the American people know this through 10 or 12 or 14 hours of a reading, but I think he may have overdone it a little bit.
But eventually, Coburn's stalling tactic resulted in more than a delay of the debate, and by mid-afternoon, Senator Sanders withdrew the amendment.
I know we don't have the votes. I know the insurance company and the drug lobbyists will fight us to the death. But mark my words, Madam President, the day will come when this country will do the right thing. And on that day, we will pass a Medicare for All single-payer system.
Sanders' plan would provide health care and dental benefits for all Americans. It would be available for everyone regardless of age and would be funded by income and payroll taxes. It would also be administered on the state level. Sanders says in his amendment, there's no role for private insurance at all.
At the end of the day, the reason why a Medicare for All single-payer system is the only way that you're going to provide comprehensive health care to all Americans in a cost-effective way is you eliminate the $350 to $400 billion of waste engendered by the private insurance companies through thousands and thousands of separate insurance programs whose goal in each and every case is to make a profit. So what you have seen in recent years is an explosion of healthcare bureaucrats who don't deliver babies, they don't treat people with cancer. Their whole function in life is administrative, and it's to make profits for the private insurance companies.
This would have been the first time that single payer was to be debated on the Senate floor. Many didn't expect it to pass this time around, but some single payer advocates say they were happy that Sanders is pushing the issue. Richard Davis is executive director of the Vermont Citizens Campaign for Health, a single payer advocacy organization.
It's historic. It's monumental. Sometimes, you know, in politics, just showing up or just having an opportunity to speak is tremendous, and this is one of those occasions. You have to start somewhere. So if you look at it realistically in a political sense, it's a beginning, and then we can look back and say, okay, we started this, and what's the next step? You know, maybe we can get a better vote in a couple of years or a year or two. So that, you know, that's sort of accepting political reality.
Sanders says he is unsure if he will support the current health care bill. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
The House of Representatives passed a spending bill today that provides more than $100 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It also extends unemployment insurance and health care for people who lost jobs in the recession, but it does not cover the cost of the additional 30,000 troops that President Obama plans to send to Afghanistan in 2010. Also today, Congress members prepared to vote on a $154 billion jobs bill. The bill is meant to augment last year's $787 billion economic stimulus plan. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
The bill would pay to create jobs for infrastructure improvements around the country, help states retain public service employees like teachers and firefighters, and extend unemployment and health benefits. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer said the $787 billion stimulus bill has not done enough to save jobs.
We've worked very hard over the last year to address the extraordinary fall in our economy that was left to us by the last administration. You've heard me say in the last month of the administration's previous administration, 741,000 people lost their jobs. Last month, 11,000 people lost their jobs. Still too many. We've made progress, but we have not had success.
Once the bill passes through the House, the Senate will have to pass their version. Congress members, such as Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas, are putting the pressure on the Senate to act quickly.
We just hope that the Republicans on the Senate don't stamp on a good idea with no ideas.
But first, Lee and House Democrats will have to get past House Republicans, who are putting up a fight. They say the bill is too expensive, even though half of it, $75 billion, will be paid for by TARP repayment funds. Republican Virginia Fox disagrees with the bill on principle.
I would just like to point out it's not the role of the federal government to provide jobs. It's not our job to take money from some and give to others to try to make them dependent on the government.
But Sheila Jackson Lee says her constituents, especially small business owners, are putting the pressure on for government assistance. She says small businesses are frustrated that Wall Street is getting most of the assistance from Washington.
I've heard frustration and hostility. If the fat cats of Wall Street are pocketing dollars every single day, and they're in charge of the banks, and why can't we get bank loans? Well, we put in place a guarantee for 90% of any loan that a small business can secure. We're not going to tolerate inertia among banks when it comes to people who create jobs. Small businesses create jobs.
Small businesses were also the theme of a Senate meeting of the Democratic Policy Committee. Economists from the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations gave recommendations to the senators on how best to jumpstart the economy. Committee Chair Byron Dorgan defended small businesses.
Somewhere up here at the top, there's recovery. They're making profits, going to pay big bonuses now, getting special tax deals. And somewhere down here at the bottom, in an area of business that really does, in my judgment, generate most of the new jobs, small and medium-sized businesses, they can't find credit.
Even if the bill passes tonight in the House, it probably will not move into the Senate until next year. Earlier this week, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said she hopes the Senate will pass the bill first thing in 2010, in time for the President's State of the Union address. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Just war or just war? Politics, it is said, makes strange bedfellows. But the Nobel Peace Prize ain't far behind. There has been considerable commentary over the award of this prize to President Barack Obama and whether or not it was deserved. His speech upon receipt of the honor was not about peace, but about war, or to be precise, just war. As if calling the Afghanistan war a just one wasn't ironic enough, to be accepting a peace prize while escalating war takes a cake. Rather than just war, perhaps the speech should have been about justifying war, something that politicians are pretty good at. One could hardly miss the contrast between Obama and Martin Luther King Jr., whose previous receipt of the award and dream oratory were drafted into the service of war. But if King were alive, he would doubtless be a protester rather than an applauder of more war. King's friend and speechwriter, the Reverend Dr. Vincent Harding, points to King's Riverside speech in New York, where he came out forcefully against the war in Vietnam. When the nation's political, religious, and media leaders defended the war as just and necessary, King saw the human suffering of Vietnamese people and found it intolerable. Obama's references to the reality of evil in world affairs thrilled conservatives, for it endorsed more war as a solution. King addressed evil squarely 42 years ago, but in King's view, war was evil, not a solution. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.